Fred Film Radio, Berlin International Film Festival, Germany.
Fred Film Radio, this is Chiara Nicoletti. Today I'm in Rome in company of Danny Boyle, who's here to present and promote the sequel of his iconic film on 1996, Trainspotting. Trainspotting 2 will be screened out of competition at the 67th Berlinale. In the first Trainspotting, music was definitely one of the protagonists, as some scenes are still defined and recognizable thanks to the music. How did you work on this part for the second film?
So when we started, Sony did a survey asking people, film goers, if there was going to be a sequel to Trainspotting, what would they want from the new film? And they all said the same three things. They wanted the original cast back, the four men. They wanted those four men, these four back. They wanted, the second one was that they wanted to know whether Kelly MacDonald would be in it as well. And the third question they asked or demanded was, would the soundtrack be as good as the first one? So nobody asked about the director. It's really sad. So that you can see the soundtrack was a big thing for people. And we wanted to use it to trigger memories, but we also didn't want to use it in a lazy way. So we remixed. If we did use the original music, it was remixed. So Prodigy did a remix of the Iggy Pop Lust for Life for us. And Rick Smith from Underworld did this amazing rethink of Born Slippy. And so you get the trigger that reminds you of something that, if you know the other film, maybe, you know, some people won't. But if you do, you there's a depth charge goes off of memory, like, oh, that resonates across you. And yet it's not just a repeat, hopefully. It's not just a replica of the first film. You know, you find it in a... It has a different resonance as well. So all the music on the soundtrack is pretty new, really. I mean, obviously Blondie and Queen are old songs. But when we've actively used the music, other than just as needle drops, we try to reimagine it for now, really.
Would you tell us more about the use of flashbacks in T2? I figure it is a narrative choice, but also a stylistic one.
Yeah, there was only one that was written, which was that when Spud gets knocked out, when he goes boxing, Raging Spud, and he gets knocked out and he comes out of the gym and he is in that big area called Carlton Road with the big arch. That was written in the script. That was the only memory in the script, deliberately staged. But we added some were to do with the muscle memory of actors on the day. Like, for instance, Renton goes up into the loft when he's running away from Begbie, and he said, shall I come up like I'm coming up out of the toilet? So he did that. He came up out of the... And some people think, you know, and it triggers a memory. So some were like that, and some we did in editing where we cut back to the original film. There's only about one minute of the other film in this film. That's looped back, because you can overdo it and get too nostalgic and too dependent on the other film. So we tried to find a balance there, so that the depth charges again were triggered by these very specific and deliberate choices. You know, the baby. So we the baby that died in the first one. We obviously, there's a little glimpse of her. She's called Dawn. She was called Dawn. And when we filmed, when you film as a director with babies, you always get twins if you can, so that you've got twice the chance of one of them being awake or sure, not crying, sure, or, you know, you switch them out like that. So when we were doing that, because we used that footage, we thought we better find out what's happened to the twins who played Dawn, because obviously it could be a bit of a PR disaster if they turn, you know, if one of them had become a mass murderer or something like that. And we found them on Facebook, and they're two very glamorous, very beautiful girls in their 20s. And they came to the premiere party, and they went round introducing themselves as the dead baby. We're the dead baby. It's a very Trainspotter kind of sense of humour.
How did Welsh react to the changes you made to the second book, Porno? And have you ever thought of working with him in an original project, maybe not an adaptation?
Yeah, Irving does do projects, I think, with other people. I think we have a wonderful relationship with this screenwriter, John Hodge, Because Irving writes the characters in a certain way in his books, and then they go through the prism of John, the screenwriter, and the actors, and they're different. They are the same character, but they're not the same. They're a different version of them, I think. And Irving's very happy with that. So he then goes back and writes them again for another book, and they're his characters again. But when we adapt them, they become ours, really, in a way. And that's a good dynamic, I think, in the relationship. He was fine about porno. We adapted it. It wasn't very good. I didn't even send it to the actors. It was like a workmanlike. It was just like another film, just any film. And I don't think we could do this one justice without really risking something, not just making another film. So we wanted to make something a bit more personal about time and about masculinity, which we all suffer from. And so we tried. That's what we tried to do. And Irving, who also suffers from time and masculinity, was happy for us to do so as well.
In the book, there are only 9 years of distance between the two stories. In the film, you chose to wait 10 years more, so there are 20. Why this choice?
We didn't really have any. I realized we didn't really have anything to say after 9 years, 10 years. There was nothing really to say. It was just. It would have been just another. It would have been a recap. It would just not even a recap. Well, we just would have replicated. It would have been a replicant of the first one. We didn't really have anything to say. It would have been them just making a porno movie, which I didn't think was very funny, and so we waited. And it's risky because we may not have ended up being able to do it, but then John wrote the script, which was more personal. Like when the character says, Renton, where is he? He says, I'm 46 and I'm fucked. And that stood for all of us, I think, in a way. That was the reason that we made the film, is to look at that. And his Choose Life speech, which obviously begins because the other one was a big hit in the other film, and it became an iconic thing. And it begins as though he's going to do the same thing with Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, which is, you know, there's lots of that online anyway, pretty much copying the original speech but updating it. But the film, the speech is much more personal. About the end of the speech is when he starts to say, choose disappointment. And also choose the fact that he's not turned up for his mother's funeral, which he feels, you know, that he has to atone for that. So it became much more, it's a much more personal film, really, in a way. In a weird kind of way, really. Even though we love the first one, and there's so much of us all in the first one, this is a bit more personal about us now, really. And I think 9 years ago, we wouldn't have been able to make that.
The first film was very good at describing the mental and emotional distress the protagonists were suffering from. And the second film is also capable of highlighting the same feelings. What do you think about hope, for example? And what do you think that the role of hope is in this film?
It's the hope is ironically expressed and captured in the most hapless, hopeless character you could imagine, which is Spud, really. Where is he? Because he seems the most... How could he ever survive? But he has. And he learns to kind of value his voice, his own voice, and starts to write it down. And obviously that becomes the first novel, if you like, that he's Irving Welsh in a way. So that's the hope, really. I mean, there are small gestures. Begbie seems to learn something about himself. You know, he apologizes to his son and his wife about... So there's that, and Renton goes back to his father. And I love that scene where he hugs his father, James Cosmo, and which is his way of apologizing, really, for the fact that he hasn't been home for 20 years. So there is some hope there, I hope. It's modest, but it's there.
Thank you, Danny Boyle, for talking to us about Trainspotting 2, screening how the competition at the 67th Berlinale, and this is Chiara Nicoletti for Fred, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio,
24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.